Yes, please. Now we have with us our one and only amazing Haj Hussain. A lot of you would know him. He is focused on developments and BRR, mainly the BRR strategy, which is buy, refurb, refinance, rent strategy, where he actually takes on rundown properties and refurbs them and actually eventually plans to hold most of them anyway. And he's amazing at what he does. So please allow me to welcome amazing Haj Hussain.
Thank you so much, Jack. Thank you, very kind of you. And thank you so much for inviting me here today. Can you all see and hear me okay?
Yes.
Excellent. So let me just get slides. I'm not using very many slides. In fact, I have a total of 5 slides, you'd be pleased to hear. So there's not many slides. Let me just get my screen organized. Just bear with me a second. Oops. Just 1 second. When you have more than one screen, that's one too many. Okay. Okay, hopefully we'll get started now. You can see and see my screen okay? Oh, no, I haven't shared it yet, have I? I'm doing really well. There you go, let's try that. Jack, give me a thumbs up, you can see the screen. Fantastic, excellent, thank you very much. So Jack, when you asked me about doing this presentation, I was absolutely delighted to want to do it. And one thing that I was thinking about is, you know, you have an amazing lineup of speakers, and I haven't been on, I have to apologize, I haven't been on earlier in the day. I've had a couple of commitments to do, and I caught the tail end of Natasha's talk. And I was thinking there's just so much knowledge that the audience will be able to pick up this over these 3 days. And I thought, okay, what value can I bring? And I'm thinking, for those that don't know, I've been involved in property for about 15 years, and I've done lots and lots of different strategies, not because I'm super amazing at doing all these strategies, is that because a little bit like Natasha was talking about earlier, I was stuck trying lots of different things and not quite getting the results. But what that did do is enabled me to build up a lot of knowledge and experience doing different strategies. And over the 15 odd years, nearly 16 years, we've used many of those different strategies. But the challenge I faced at the beginning, and if you're anything like me, when you're learning about property, you're learning about all these different strategies, what happens is you get overwhelmed. And we get overwhelmed because there's so much information, we don't know which is going to be the right strategy to use. And when I started at the beginning, it really took me about 2 years to be able to get the first deal across the line. And many people would have given up way before that. And Jack just talked about persistence and massive action taking just now when he's talking to, I think it was Rajesh, the sales guy for the estate agents. It's about taking lots of action. And I felt like I was taking all the right action, but just not getting the right result. And I don't know if you've ever experienced that. You just feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall and not quite getting the result. But the one thing I did have was persistence and perseverance. And I kind of kept pushing and kept pushing. And eventually we got a deal across the line after 2 years. But the distraction at the beginning was what was happening is I would spend a huge amount of time going to learn from other people. I'd go to lots of events, networking events, a really big networker. That's kind of how I've grown my contacts all the time. And I'd hear somebody talking about they're doing HMOs and they're making £1,000 a month doing HMOs. And I'm thinking, yes, that's what I need to be doing, £1,000 a month, a couple of those and I'm sorted. And I'll try to learn about how that strategy works and what they're doing. And, you know, a couple of months later, I'm listening to somebody else talking about property investing and they're saying, you can buy a house for £1. I'm thinking, forget HMOs, I'll be buying lots of properties. I've got 10 grid, I can probably buy 10 houses. So I'm off learning about sort of buying a house for £1 and you know, very quickly discover you need more than £1 to buy a house, but persevered with that. And then, you know, a couple of months later, I'm hearing somebody else talking about they're doing no money down. I'm thinking, forget the pound, I'm now off to learn about no money down. And, you know, we jump around and I joke now, but I can tell you at the time it was not a joke. I was really struggling, jumping around, strategy to strategy, trying different things and really not getting the result. So one of the things I want to try and share with you today, there's kind of 3 parts of what I want to share with you. And I'm not going to explain in advance what they are. I'm just going to go through them. So the first part of what I want to talk about is really understanding a strategy. And I caught a tail end of what Natasha was talking about as well. I think this will bolt on nicely to what she was talking about. So one of the things I run is a number of workshops. One of the workshops is a Property Insider's Edge, which is like an initial get started workshop. And in that, we talk about trying to get your strategy right. And this bit I've taken essentially from that. Now, when we're trying to think about a strategy, the way I take this into to try and work this out, so I break it into seven key considerations that you need to think about, i.e. what you're going to be able to bring to the table, what strengths, skills you already have, in order to find which strategy is going to work for you. Because it's okay watching somebody else getting some fantastic results in a strategy. You don't necessarily need to see the 10 years that they've put to be able to get to that particular point, at that level of mastery of that particular strategy. Or in some cases, sometimes people have been doing it for 3 months, got a couple of great results, and you know, now they're off teaching other people. But we won't talk about that. So seven key considerations. Now, these, I haven't got slides that I've that I'm going to run through this with. I'm just essentially going to share with you on camera. But what I do have is a video where I talk about the strategy. If you want to learn more about that, just ping me a message on social media afterwards. I'll give you my contact details in a little while. So the first one is understanding really what access you have to time, how much time you have available. Some people be coming into property with a huge amount of time, i.e. they've given up whatever else they're doing, and now they're doing property full time. So you've got a full week, what's that, 40 hours, 80 hours, 100 hours, however many hours you're going to be putting into it. However, many people, they're often doing something else. They've got a day job, they might be studying, they're doing a couple of part-time things. And this has got to fit in around that. So it's thinking about how much time that you're going to be able to bring to this property investing strategy. Because the more time you have, the more hands-on you can be as well. So for example, if you've got lots of time, you've got a huge amount of time available to you in terms of the amount of time you can be able to commit to property investing, then it may be you're looking at some of the more hands-on type strategy like service accommodation or HMOs, which involve a lot more time. And you know, you can do the simpler strategy as well, like buy to let, which don't need as much time. But generally, if you're time rich, you might be looking at some of the strategies that are either more systems orientated or that they need more of your involvement to be able to run them and build them up. The second thing to then think about is what access you have to capital. Now, this isn't necessarily how much money you've got sitting in the bank right now that you're going to have available to start your property investing journey with. This is how financeable are you? How much your ability to be able to go and raise money from other people, be able to take mortgages. So for example, your traditional finance, your mortgaging, are you mortgageable on a very basic level? And if you're not, what is it you need to do to get that put right? For example, it could be like credit file issues need to be looked at. Sometimes it could be minor things. Somebody may feel that they can't get a mortgage because their credit score is quite low. And it may just be that they're not on the voters roll. Something as little as that can make a big difference to your overall credit score. But just think about what access you have to cash. But of course, there's also things like asset-based lending available, which you know, Jack's involved in as well, like bridging finance, where it's less about you as the individual, it's more about the asset. So yes, there's finance available that way. Often that's not the cheapest way to do it. Well, my preference has always been using other people's money. That's essentially how I've grown my business over the years. The thing that I absolutely focus on, we still do that today as well. And it's trying to create that win-win. I'm going to talk more about that in a short while. So with finance, it's not necessarily how much money you've got sitting in the bank. It's what money you can tap into, how you know mortgageable you might be able to be. Because the level of money that you're going to have available is also going to help you either accelerate a particular strategy that you're using, or it may be that it hinders you because if you're limited with the amount of money. So sometimes people talk about, let's do rent-to-rent because you don't need very much money. I know I've done a lot of rent-to-rent over the years. I was teaching rent-to-rent about 7 years ago, running workshops then. And at that time, yes, there were some properties we take on. We need very little money spending on them. Then it's really about just making them work, running them, operating them. But other times, you know, there's rent-to-rent properties that I've taken on that I've spent like £15,000-£20,000 on. Sometimes people think I'm absolutely crazy when I'm spending 20 grand on somebody else's property that we don't own and we've got no right to buy it. It's just a lease on that particular property. However, if I'm going to be generating, for example, say £1,000 a month over a year, at least £10,000, and I've got a 10-year lease, that's £100,000 I'm going to generate from a property I don't own. So when you put it into that context, it can make sense. Now, however, in that example, I still need £20,000 to get started to renovate the property and do whatever we need to do. So with cash is thinking about, you know, which sort of strategy is going to be right for you. You know, if you're cash rich, for example, buying property for cash, quick purchases, auction purchases, distress sales, all those things are opened up to you, trading property where you're buying and selling it straight on as well. Now, the third consideration really is around your experience. What level of experience you already have? Now, many people that get involved in property don't really have property investing experience. They're starting out from ground zero. They're kind of building that up. Or other people may be coming into this because they've already got a couple of buy-to-lets and now they just want to build that business up. Now, with experience, it's really taking a step back and thinking about what experience that you have that may be transferable, which experiences you currently have that you might be able to build, bring into this business. So for example, it may be that you work as an IT project manager. Now, if you're an IT project manager, you already have skills around managing. You're just managing a different type of thing. But if you're going into property renovations, property refurbish, and managing those type of projects, there'll be some skills that'll be transferable. So it's recognizing there'll always be some experiences that you can bring into this. Rather than parking them at the door and say, hey, I'm making a fresh start, think about what skills can you bring with you into this business that you'll be able to utilize. And it may be, this reminds me of the conversation I had with a solicitor once. She's a commercial solicitor working in conveyancing, and she was talking about getting involved in property. And I said, so tell me about your experience and what you're doing. This is before I knew she was a solicitor. And she said, look, I've got no experience. I've never done this before. And I asked her, what is it that you do as a day job? And she goes, I'm a commercial property solicitor. And I said, hang on a minute, you're a commercial property solicitor, and you're saying to me you've got no experience. I said, that's not true. You're just not recognizing that you have certain skills that you can benefit from and utilize within this industry. So, you know, whether you're in a state agency background, involved with lettings, you're a plumber or a builder or anything like that, all these experiences are useful that are transferable that you can bring into property, and thinking about which ones are really going to help you in which strategies. Now, with this, you'll very quickly be realizing I'm not telling you what strategies to do. I'm telling you about the things that you need to think about in order to pick which strategy is going to work best for you. And with experience, sometimes people talk about, look, you know, hey, there's certain things I'm not very good at, and there's other things I'm very good at, so I need to work harder at the things I'm not good at. Now, I don't agree with that. I don't think that's the way you should be approaching this. So, for example, I'm quite capable of doing accounts for our business. I really don't enjoy doing it. It's kind of really something I revel in, but, you know, I'm quite capable of doing it. So do I spend more time and effort getting better at doing the accounts? Or actually, should I be focusing on things I'm already good at, very good at, and making those things even better? And I think it's the latter for me. I think we should be focusing on the things that we're already good at and really turn that into our superpower. So we are absolutely awesome at doing certain things, but then we can delegate the things we're not so good at. We shouldn't be working on, my belief is, on the things we're not that great at, because those are things we can pass to other people and let them do those for us in order so we can focus on things that we're absolutely awesome at to get the best possible results. Now, number four is the level of knowledge you're already coming into. It's a little bit of an overlap between experience and knowledge, number three and four. So the level of knowledge you're coming into in this particular business. So there might be already some experience that you have, for example, like the solicitor is a good example, or surveyors. You know, you have a certain level of knowledge and understanding of the business. It might be you need to broaden that understanding, or you go deeper down onto a specific type of strategy and how you're going to use that. So, for example, an estate agent, with all due respect, I love them to bits. An estate agent is really a glorified salesperson. They just happen to be selling property. It could be anything they're selling, but their skill is in selling. So when you're coming from a background like that and you have that sort of knowledge, you think about, okay, what sort of things are going to suit me well? Well, they're going to work very well sitting in front of people, speaking to them. That might be the seller of the property when you try and negotiate a deal. That might be with another estate agent when they're trying to negotiate deals. Or it may even be with an investor when you're trying to raise money, because they have the soft people skills in order to be able to communicate effectively, be able to influence and get a result. And so it's thinking about what knowledge that you have, these are parts of your strengths, that, and thinking about which strategy that works well with. Now, if you're very introverted, for instance, if you're somebody that maybe loves spreadsheets, you know, you love Excel and you really enjoy on the research and the analysis side, on the deals and the appraisal side, then if that's your strength, then you're probably not going to be suited so well by putting you in front of people when where you need really more of the softer skills, the like I was just talking about, where the communication or influence skills are important. Is this making sense? Give me a little bit of a thumbs up. This is a very interactive session, by the way. So that means you can stop me at any time. You don't have to wait till the end for questions. If you've got anything you want to ask me, you just unmute and say, hey, Sad, you've got a question. It's no problem at all. And we can just jump straight into that. So a few thumbs up there. So thank you very much for that. So Jack, maybe you can put those thumbs down, because I'm not quite sure how to do those. Thank you. So the next thing then to think about, number five, is the location. Where are you based in the country? So I'm in Birmingham. You know, I love Birmingham. I think it's the center of the world. It's the best possible place. The only thing we don't get enough of here is the sun. But hey, I can't do a lot about that. But other than that, this is the best place in the world to live, I think anyway. Now, when you're investing in property, sometimes people invest literally on their doorstep. Other times they'll be investing hundreds or thousands of miles away. Sometimes people say to me, what do you think about investing in Dubai? I says, I've no idea. You know, it's not really an area I know anything about. my view, you should be focusing on your front doorstep and, you know, within about 40 odd minutes to get to a property from there. That's the rule that we tend to use. So it's about 40, 45 minutes, absolute max. If we can get to it from our office, then we're okay looking at it in terms of location. And for us, that generally means it's the West Midlands. And beyond that, we're not really interested because, well, one is a little bit of a comfort thing for us. Secondly, and more importantly, that's where our connections are, our knowledge bases, our understanding of the area, the demographics, the type of people that live there, and even how the market moves and market adjusts as well. So the strategies that you use, depending on where you live, will vary. So for example, you know, what we're doing in Birmingham right now, the strategies that work might be very different. What works in London may be very different what works in Hull, for example. So for instance, if I'm looking for 15% below market value property right now, I'm really going to struggle to find that in Birmingham. Now, just to be clear, I'm not saying they don't exist, but it's like finding a needle in a haystack. Whether as far as finding one of the cheaper northern towns, which is maybe a little bit more deprived, you're going to be much easier finding discounted property there. But you have to think about why is it you're looking for that discounted property? What's the objective? If you're trying to flip it on, then the one of the reasons it's going to be lower price because there isn't much of a demand there. And the reason at the moment in Birmingham we can't find discounted property because the property market's on fire, as it is in many places. The prices are so high, demand sky high, and there isn't enough supply. So thinking about the location and how the market might be different. So the market isn't really consistent throughout the country. Thinking about what type of strategies will work better in certain locations. So for example, if you're looking at lease options, there'll be certain things that you need to look for that will work better in certain markets than there will in other places. The next one, number six, is really thinking about your existing contacts, connections that you might have. Now, this is not necessarily people you already know immediately. Like, for example, Bob, your brother-in-law is a builder. It's not about sort of immediate contacts. It's thinking about your further and bigger network and connections through connections a lot. Like LinkedIn talks about secondary connections. Who do you know through people or who could you connect to through people that could potentially help you? So, for example, if there is a distant relative that's an estate agent, or you know, if you've got a family friend that is a builder, all of these things are advantageous to you within your property investing journey. And the more people that are aware, Shipla, I think you're maybe need to mute. I'd love to get the kids involved, but it might be a bit challenging for everybody else. Thank you. So with contacts, it's thinking about the more people you know, the easier it is to get things done. So earlier I mentioned that networking has been a key part of my property investing journey. It's about building the contacts, connections, and so much so that, you know, I've run property networking events for many, many years. In fact, outside of London, we run the largest property event each month in Birmingham. And really it is allows to meet more people, connect with more people, and constantly grow that network. And social media is a form of networking as well. So how are you growing your contacts and your network? Some of these people that you already know or may know or kind of know through somebody else, they may be people that might be able to help you. There could be somebody, for example, as a commercial surveyor. It could be, as I said, an estate agent. It could be people that work in finance, in mortgage broking. These are all potential contacts. Now, what we're trying to do is stack up all the things that are in our favor. What do we have that are advantageous to us, or a little bit like a SWOT analysis, as Natasha mentioned earlier on, is thinking about what's the strengths that we have, what are the things that we can really stack up in our favor before we start thinking about which is going to be the right strategy to use. And the seventh and final one within the things that you really need to consider before you nail down a strategy is thinking about where you are investing and where that might be within the property investing cycle. So as we know, property works in a boom bust kind of phase. Sometimes the property price is really high, other times it might be flat, other times it might be in a bust situation, and alternatively maybe in a recovery. They're kind of the four phases. So most places right now are sort of fairly boom-ish situation. Maybe some of them are starting to flatten out a little bit, but the cycles don't all move at the same pace. Different cycles in different areas will move different places. So depending on what you want to. So for instance, if you're, what for example I found worked quite well is in a bus situation, lease option. Lease option worked really well in 2008, 9, 10, when I was doing lots of lease options at that time, because there was lots of people, for example, negative equity, lots of people struggling to sell. There were very few buyers. There were a lot more sellers. We could put creative deals together. So in that sort of phase, And then I know that lease option works really well in that location, particularly in the lower price property areas as well. And, you know, once that cleaned up, we did very well out of it during that time, because it's combining all these things, these seven things that I'm just talking about now. So just to summarize, and if I talk fast, my apologies, I just get kind of really excited about this stuff. The first one is just thinking about how much time you have. Second one, what access you have to money. Third is the level of experience that you already have that might be transferable. The knowledge that that you have, maybe, for example, existing understanding of a property overall. The location that you're based or thinking about investing in. For example, if you're in an expensive part of London, you might not be investing on your doorstep. You might pick something that's 200 miles away, which is perfectly fine, but you need to make sure you've got your power team and people there that can be able to support you. And which rolls us on to number six, which is connections and contacts, what contacts you already have. And number seven then is where you might be in the property property cycle. So these are kind of key things that we need to be thinking about before we work out our strategies. So this weekend or the next 3 days, you're going to be learning so much by so many different people. But think about, are you the person that that strategy will suit really well? What I try and explain it as, does that strategy fit you like a glove? Or does it feel a little bit clunky trying to force it and make it work for you? Because the more naturally it feels, the more you can resonate with that particular strategy and how it works, the easier it's going to be for you to get success and results in that particular strategy. Because here's the thing, and you may not have, you probably already heard this weekend. If you haven't, I'm sure you will. Property investing is not easy. It is not a walk in the park. It is hard work. And there's going to be times where you're going to be frustrated. There's going to be challenges you're going to have. You're going to have builders are going to go AWOL on you. You're going to have solicitors not coming back to you. You're going to have sellers are going to walk away from a deal. You know, you're going to find that you've got major problems, structure issues with the property that you weren't aware of. And not all these things will happen. And if they happen all on one property, then you have a lot of bad luck. Hey, I'm kidding. It's unlikely all that's going to happen on one property. Point I'm making is you're going to find challenges along the way. That's the time we've got to dig deep and push on. And because, you know, we've got a strong reason why we're doing this. There's a strong why we're actually doing this. And that's what keeps pushing us forward. So, you know, property is hard work, but the rewards are absolutely massive. The rewards are phenomenal. There's very few things I believe that you can do that are long-term going to create the amount of wealth that you can create through property. Well, that kind of leads me on to why many people get involved in property. Often people are interested in property, not because they're passionate about the bricks and mortar and the architecture and the design. And yes, they might be interested in those things, but often it's just the money. It's the ka-ching, ka-ching. That's why people get predominantly interested in property. It's about the money it's going to make for them. And that money might be something that they want to use to kind of change their immediate lifestyle. Like they want to maybe leave their job and kind of create something that gives them a more of a passive income. It might be that something they want to build up as an extra income. It might be something for the future, for as a pension. It might be a legacy. Whatever the reasons are, most of it all boils down to is a case of creating cash, and property is a way of creating cash. And I've always been a fan of the Sunday Times Rich List. In fact, I've got nearly every single edition here in my cupboard over here from day one. And one of the things that really fascinated me, and I discovered quite early on when I used to kind of read through the magazines as they were published each year, was there's so many people that either make money from property or they keep money in property that are in the rich list. And in this country, we are obsessed about property. If we cross over the shores and go over to Europe and France and Germany, there is no obsession about property as there is here. People don't buy buy-to-let investment property. In fact, many people live in rented homes. They don't even own them. And that's because it's just not the same. But here, culturally, very different. And, you know, we have terms like as safe as houses, because it's a solid, safe investment. Now, you know, you can become a crypto billionaire overnight, probably. But is it stable like property? Oh, it's not the same thing. So property is, if you understand it, you build a solid platform, you can build a very healthy income off the back of that. Now, regardless of which strategy that you choose to pick and which strategy you work with, I think there's two core fundamentals, which are the next two things I want to talk about. There's two core fundamentals that you need to get absolutely right to succeed, regardless of what property strategy that you pick. And that is your ability to be able to get out there and find good quality deals, and your ability to be able to find the money to fund those deals. Now, if you master these two things, it doesn't really matter which strategy you pick. You will succeed because you'll have a constant flow of deals so that you can pick out the best deals. Even if you mess up, they fall out of bed. You've got constant flow of deals, and you've got constant flow of potential investors that want to work with you to fund those deals. If you get those two things right, your journey is going to be so much more easier and you're much more likely to succeed. So I want to talk about these two things for a moment. Now, the bit that I just did on the seven considerations, if you want to just one second, what's up on my slides? Can I see my slides? Jack, thumbs up. Yeah, excellent. Okay, so there, that's my contact details on social media. I'll flash it up again a little bit later on. If you want to reach out to me, just ping a message and I can send you a link to a video with that in more detail. I think there's a chat comment here, but let me just check we're not missed anything. Excellent. Okay, that's fine. So I much prefer talking to the camera like having slides. Now, when it comes to finding deals, which is really kind of the bread and butter of what, you know, regardless of what strategy you're doing, whether you're doing HMOs, you're doing rent to rent, whether you're flipping deals, you're doing commercial conversion, you're building houses, you've got to find the deals in the first place. With no deals, there is no strategy and there is no money at the end of it. You've got to be able to find the deals. So finding deals is something many people struggle with, particularly now in this market, because as we said, the market's so strong, it's so buoyant, there's so many people trying to buy property, there's so much money sloshing around that people are overpaying for property right now. Now, that makes it much more challenging, more difficult when we're trying to find deals. And when I started, about 15 years ago at that time, the strategy that I started with, or the one that I actually started making some money with, should I say, was actually sourcing deals. And it wasn't because I was a brilliant sourcer. It was just right timing, right place, and accidentally doing some of the things I was talking about just earlier on. And that was getting out there, talking to people, and very quickly realizing there's many people that want to sell and are trying to sell property, and for whatever reason, unable to, the property might be overpriced, in which case we look at maybe a lease option, or it might be that they need to sell quickly, in which case we're looking at below market value sales, fast transactions. You know, what happened is I started going out, speaking to people, and starting getting very good at finding these deals, and then I start selling these deals to other people. So I was effectively a sourcer at that time, or what I call now glorified estate agent, except we're just getting paid by the buyer, the investors, as opposed to seller of the property. That's the only real difference. Now, at that time, what I was doing is focusing on just trying to find what I think was a good deal. And yeah, there's a big question mark, what's a deal? What is a deal anyway? In fact, actually, let me do a little quick question. What I'd like to do is for you to tell me what you think a deal is. Pop into the chat box. This way, just I know that not everyone's asleep as well, or having their afternoon tea or something. And I'm not just speaking to myself. I can see about three or four cameras on. So what's a deal? How do you define a deal? Jack?
A deal, in simple words, is that at least going to make you profit after you've paid yourself wages.
Yeah. What else? What else could a deal be? We've got a couple in the chat box. They're trying to move quickly now. Let me try and catch up. I might need my glasses for this one. Rashmi saying value you bring to a buyer that they are happy to pay for. Yes. Paul saying it's a win-win for both parties. Margaret, something that gives all parties what makes them happy. And Alan saying a transaction with opportunity for profit. They're all saying very similar things. And the way I tend to view it is a deal is an opportunity to make money from property. That's what we're talking about. There can be many, many different ways. It's an opportunity to make money. So if I'm bringing you a deal, that means there should be some opportunity for you to monetize that, to be able to get some benefit out of it. And if you can't, then hey, isn't a deal. And when we crunch our numbers, when we look at our deal analysis, what are we looking for? We're looking for, is there any money in it for us? Are we going to get any profit out of it? Are we hitting that return on investment that we wanted? Whatever it might be, that's what we're looking for. So when we're talking about deals and searching for deals and sourcing deals, you first have to be clear, what is a deal? What is it that you're looking for? Because the reality is, if you don't know what you're looking for, how do you recognize it when it shows up? It's staring at you in the face and you don't actually know it's a deal because you don't quite know what it is that you're actually looking for. So the beginning, when I was sourcing, you know, anything that had an opportunity to make money, I was saying it's a deal. But very quickly, what I found, what most people were focusing on at that particular moment in time, was below market value, because the market was such that everybody wanted 25% below market value or more so that they could structure the deals no money down. That was the hot strategy at the time. That's what everybody was doing. Same day remortgages. The property's worth £100,000. You secure a deal at £75,000. I sell the opportunity to somebody else. I charge them £2,000-£3,000. They do a same day remortgage and end up with the property for free, effectively, because they get 75% or 80% loan to value on the mortgage as they were doing then. Now, that's a strategy many people are using. It's not one that's used today, but it was one that was very popular at that time. So what I was doing, trying to get out there and find deals and source deals for people. But at that time, I wasn't really struggling with finding deals. What I was struggling with was finding buyers for the deals, because many people were fearful. The market was still falling. Prices were still dropping. You didn't really know where the market was going to go. So if you're buying a property cheap today, it could be even a lower price tomorrow in a couple of months' time, because people are uncertain about the market. That creates fear. That means there's lack of confidence that people don't buy. So finding all these deals, but it's really struggling to sell them. But slowly I started building some relationships with people that actually did buy and had a little bit of confidence that were buying for the long term. And many people were talking about, well, I'm going to wait until, you know, we hit the bottom of the market. So how do we know we've hit the bottom of the market? This is the interactive part, by the way.
I don't think there's a way to tell. And I don't think anyone could really predict.
Absolutely, Jack, you're absolutely right. There is no way of knowing you're at the bottom of the market until after the event. So we can look back and say, oh, that was the bottom of the market, because now it's starting to go up. So when you're waiting for the bottom of the market, you will only know once you've passed the event. So it's about buying for as long as your number stack and it works for you. So whether you're finding deals for yourself or whether you find deals for other people, you need to get clear about exactly what it is that you're actually looking for, what those numbers are. Then it doesn't really matter what everybody else is doing. So for example, you've gone to an auction to buy, you work out what you can pay for that property based on what you're going to do with it. It has no relevance what other people might be willing to pay or what they might be willing to do with it, because you have a strategy and you should stick to that in terms of what you're doing. So what I want to do is, you know, we run some workshops I mentioned earlier on. We run a sourcing workshop as well. And I've picked within that, we talk about 41 different ways that we've used to find a deal. So I want to pick on three things I want to just share with you, kind of things that are maybe a little bit different, not the kind of things that you probably hear all the time, because what I'm trying to do is add value for you, give you some of the kind of things that may be useful that you can utilize straight away this weekend. So one of the ones that I really like using is searching for deals on the planning portal, the local authority planning portal. So what's a local authority planning portal? Well, when you're making applications for planning, you've got to submit for planning approval and they sit on the portal. It's a public portal. Everybody can see what's on there, who's applied for what, what's been approved, what's been declined there. So how do you find deals there? Where's the opportunity there? Well, it's thinking about motivation, because really when we're looking for deals, what we're looking for is somebody that's either motivated to sell. What does even motivation mean? If somebody puts a property up for sale with an estate agent, are they motivated to sell? Heck yeah, they're motivated to sell. They're motivated to sell the property, but not the level of motivation we're looking for, because there's different degrees of motivation, right? So what we're looking for is somebody that's more motivated than most that wanting to sell, either eager, they're keen to sell. Now, let's say somebody's gone through a complicated planning application, it's dragged on for months, and that's been declined at the end of it. Do you think they'll have a level of frustration that they're facing right now? They might be ready to throw in the towel and say, hey, I'm ready to get out of this deal. That's just one example of where somebody might be looking to exit. Then there might be an application that dragged on for months and months to be able to get to an approval. And at that time, the person's circumstances have changed and they don't necessarily want to do what they wanted to do originally, because it's just taken so long and everything's just moved on. So even if someone's got an approval, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't approach them as potentially for a property. And you're not going to get hundreds of these. You're going to get a few of these every single week in your area. So you could go through every single application, standard letter you send straight out and say, hey, congratulations on your planning application, or my commiserations on your planning application, whatever the outcome was. And say, I just want to reach out to you and say, look, you know, if you would even consider selling your property, maybe even leasing it, if you're thinking about lease options or something like that, please reach out to me. Here's my number. Now, letters, just whilst I'm on the topic of letters, I'm trying not to get on my high horse here when it comes to letters. There's so many letters I see that people write pages and pages when they're writing to a vendor in order to get them to call them. So we talk about letters to HMO landlords or, you know, direct to vendor stuff. And we, you know, there's reams of this stuff that we see that goes out there. My view is that most of us are not skilled copywriters. We don't have the ability to be able to sell in the written form. So why on earth are we trying to write reams of stuff to try and persuade people to do something when really it's one outcome we want? That one outcome is please pick up the phone or call me. That's it. That's all that we want. So we should have a simple one paragraph maybe that's fairly intriguing. That's enough for them to think, I should maybe ring this chap. That's all that we want. So when it comes to letters, we should keep them really simple, regardless of, this is my view, regardless of you know, how you contact them. So right now we're talking about planning portal, whether it's direct to vendor in another form or it's, you know, HMO landlord letters, whatever it might be, just keep it really simple because your objective is for them to get it, pick up the phone and call you. Now, just on a side note, when you do have a conversation with an owner of a property, often what you're looking for may not be what they want. So that doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't go anywhere at that moment in time, but you, at least you've captured their details. You've now got a contact number. You've got a name also maybe that you may not have had before. And now you can follow up, whether that's a text once a month, it's a, you know, a letter every 3 months, whatever it might be. You've got a way now, have you opened up a method of communication. Probably more than half the deals we do started off as a no. We're not interested in your proposal. We're not interested in your offer. That doesn't mean no, we'd never do business with you. That just means no, not right now. But as people's circumstances change, as the motivation changes, then they become more open to looking at different ways of doing business with you. So coming back to the planning portal, was that useful? Kind of gone off like a bit on a tangent there, but hopefully it was useful. So when with the planning portal, what we're looking for is any applications that have been approved, declined, or withdrawn. They're the three that normally the category they'll fall into. It doesn't really matter. What you're doing is sending out a letter to say, hey, if you would even consider selling or maybe even leasing your property, please call me on this number. Now, that one letter may not have the impact. What you should do is do three letters. The reason you should do three letters is the first one, there'll be some people that'll be ready to pick up the phone and give you a call. The vast majority may not be interested in what you're offering or suggesting and may never call you. And that's fine. You're not trying to work on them. Your first letter will hopefully get the ones that are keen to talk to you. Your second letter should get the ones that are sitting on the fence. They're the ones that you want. The ones that are not interested, you don't spend your time on them because it's much easier to go for the ones that are kind of thinking about it or may be interested in speaking with you. So the ones that are sitting on the fence, your second letter will be something along the lines of, hey, wrote to you recently, not sure if you missed a letter. Here's essentially what I was saying. I'm really interested in your property. I'm only looking to acquire one in this area right now. And I'm having a couple of the conversation. I really don't want you to miss out. Please call me if you'd consider selling. That's it. You're just trying to kind of push them a little further and say, look, don't miss out. You know, because I'm not looking to buy loads of these. I'm not one of these big corporations with an unlimited budget. And so you're just trying to encourage them a little bit more to respond to the letter. But that's it. Simple as that. So planning portals, I think, are a bit of a gold mine. For many other reasons as well, when it comes to sourcing, for example, recently, we do a lot of HMOs, and recently I came across a planning application. I won't kind of give the specifics as it will kind of make it a bit obvious which property I'm talking about. They got planning approval for a number of properties to convert all of them into HMOs. And I was just surprised and shocked how they got the approval. And also the layout of the properties, the way they laid them out. They weren't really studios. They weren't really HMO rooms. And I was quite intrigued about how they did that. So the first thing I did, jumped on the planning portal, looked at the documents, looked at who the architect was, and got straight onto the phone to the architect. See, now I've got an in straight away with somebody who's done something that I'm curious and interested about how they've done it. Do you see? So for example, when you're talking to an architect that might be doing, say, a lot of HMOs, if you're doing HMOs in Article 4 area, and you found ones that get approved, well, then you talk to that architect because they understand how to get the approvals. And what you should be looking for is getting the architect who understands how to get the approvals, then go and talk to the failed application union architects who don't understand what they're doing. And sometimes that could be minor things. Those applications have been declined because little things they didn't quite understand. And then you use the other architect, the one who knows what they're doing, to help rectify that application. To see how you can create an opportunity at something that doesn't exist. And it, you may not even want to purchase it yourself. You just put the thing together and you can offer it to somebody else. You just charge a sourcing fee if that's what you're doing. But really, the amount of time we spend on Rightmove, if you just took a small percentage of that, spent that on your planning portal, you'll find there's an unlimited number of opportunities and deals that exist there. So that's one of the methods that we like to use, which is the planning portal. Another one is professionals that work in the industry. And one of my favorite ones is mortgage brokers. So how are mortgage brokers going to give you deals? How are they going to find you deals? Well, I kind of discovered this by accident when I was doing a lot of lease options. What I found was the mortgage broker knew who they couldn't mortgage, who was over leveraged, who was struggling to come up a mortgage product, whose purchase had failed because they'd prepared the mortgage and they couldn't buy the property. So they had access to all these people, and it was just trying to put together deals and opportunities that would work for them. Now, it doesn't mean the mortgage broker would sit there and give you all this data because it's confidential data, but you could put things together in terms of what works. So for example, if you've got people, or the mortgage broker rather, has people that they're not able to remortgage because they need to remortgage, they need to get off a current product, they need to refinance, whatever it is, and they're not able to, and they're stuck because there'd be many reasons why somebody can't remortgage, then all the broker would do is maybe get in touch with them and say, look, you know, I've got somebody that might have a chat with you about, they can do some creative things with the property, or they might even be doing interest in a straight purchase. If that's something you want to explore, give this person a ring. That's it. There's no data breach there. They've just suggested that they maybe speak to me. I might be able to help them. So they start bringing in a little trickle of leads. And again, you put your creative hat on in terms of what you can do with those deals. You don't have to purchase all those deals. Often it's a tie. Often with these things, it's thinking about, you pick out the deals that you want. You package up other deals and you just offer them to other people. And by earning a few £1,000 by selling deals on, that's not going to make you rich. But what that does, it then funds your marketing efforts that you're doing, that time and effort you're putting in. And then if you get other people to help you, whether it's licking stamps, you know, or whatever it might be, you know, you can afford to pay other people to help you rather than have to do all these things yourself. Making sense? A few nods? Fantastic. Okay, so the next one, the third way in terms of looking at deals is auctions. Now, obviously, we know there's three ways to buy deals, to buy property in auctions. It's either you turn up at the auction day and you stick your hand up and you'll end up with a property if you bid high enough, or you might be able to negotiate something before the event. And generally, you're paying above the guideline prices to secure something, particularly in a hot market like this. Or it may be the property doesn't sell and you speak to the auctioneers afterwards and try and see if you can secure a deal. Generally speaking, at that point, the seller's fairly motivated. Now, that's what most people would do, and that's the end of it. However, there are some properties that don't sell at the auction, they don't sell post-auction, and the vendor is becoming very motivated. Now, if you follow up with the ones that don't sell within a couple of months, so they're getting to the point which is outside the contract period with the auctioneers as well, and you'll be able to access those details because you've got the details from the auction catalogs anyway. You just keep an eye on the auction, what hasn't sold. You keep a note of which ones they are. You can download the legal pack so you know who their solicitors are. You can reach out to the solicitors to connect to them. So it's a case of how do you connect them? The legal pack's got the details there. Sometimes you'll have on the title documents the names of the owners or address details of the owners anyway. Bearing in mind, this will be outside of the contract period with the auctioneers. Another easy way to start a conversation. Now, these kind of things, most people either don't do or not prepared to put the effort in. There isn't a lot of effort. If you're looking for a property anyway, you've probably got an eye on what's happening in your local auction house. And you'll see what hasn't sold. And the stuff that hasn't sold, just keep a note of that. Follow up in a couple of months' time. Just download all the relevant documents now in case they're not available afterwards. Just put them in a folder and just come back to them afterwards. And that's much easier in terms of to follow that up and get conversations going. There's a very good deal that we got. We're nearly complete right now, which has come through a similar route to this. Is kind of pretty much what I'm just sharing with you now in terms of how we've got this. And the figure is much, much lower than what the seller's initial expectation was. Now, the reason it didn't sell at the auction, because it was ridiculously overpriced in the first place. Then secondly, the paperwork was a complete mess. The paperwork wasn't right. We knew how to fix that, but we didn't want to bid at the auction because the price was silly. But then now we've started the conversation and I'm fairly hopeful that deal will get done at a price that we think will work for us as well. Now, Well, I've got a little bonus one here for you as well. So rather than three, I'll give you one extra one in terms of sourcing deals. Another one, often people talk about direct to vendor. But how do you get in front of a vendor? When you're trying to buy property directly from the seller, who is the main person or kind of group of people you're competing with? Your main competition is the estate agents, because they are out there looking for people who want to sell their property, and they'll list it on their fancy websites and a right move for them, because that's what people perceive as a normal thing to do. So how do you get in front of those people? Well, one way is you compete with the agent doing direct to vendor marketing, which is a lot of stuff that we've done previously in the past. A lot of it was printed stuff, leaflets, newspapers, you know, ugly marketing, branding on cars, ugly branding on cars. A lot of that stuff we used to do over the previous years, not doing so much of it recently. But one of the easier ways is you look for agents that give you direct access to the vendor anyway. So sometimes Purple Bricks would do that. And like now you've got Strike as a new agent, a national agent, where they list the property. And often the conversations are direct with the owner. Now, what you're doing here is you're not bypassing the agent. That's not the objective. The objective is to be able to have a direct one-to-one conversation with the owner, particularly if you want to do something a little bit creative. If you've got lease options or any kind of creative deals or vendor finance or something fancy, assisted sales you want to put together, it's so difficult to be able to articulate that to your agent, get them on board to get them to understand it, and then get the agent to articulate that to the vendor. It's just not going to happen. It gets lost in translation. It's so difficult to do. I'll say it's not going to happen. It's just a chance of it working a slim. But if you can do that directly yourself, speak to the seller, ask questions, understand their needs, work out what they want, try and put a solution together and say, hey, look, you know, I'm not sure if this could work, but based on what you've said, I think if we were able to do this, could this work for you? And would we be able to structure it in this way? You know, you just kind of, you've got the opportunity to explore then, come up with solutions, particularly in a market that's quite hot, where you don't want to pay high prices for property. And for example, that could even be like an assisted sale, where you're partnering with them. We've done this a number of times, where you partner with the owner of the property and you don't purchase, but you go in and fund the renovation. You get the renovation done, you get the improvements done, and then you sell the property and you share that profit. Effectively, you either fix the figure with them what you've given them at the beginning, or that might just be the asking price because nobody else is willing to pay that. And then you've put your renovation funds in, 10, 15, 20 grand, whatever it might be. You're selling at a certain price and that profit then is yours. Yeah. So that's an assisted sale. You know, we've done that a number of times. You don't do loads and loads of those, but it's just about having an open mind about what you can do with the deals, what you can do with the property. And when you're speaking directly to a seller, again, we're looking for people that are motivated. There's degrees of motivation. The ones that are fairly motivated, that's what we're trying to identify. If they're fairly motivated, then we might figure a conversation going. Now, if an estate agent has just listed the property on the market just now, and it's on for like £200,000, and you talk to the end of the vendor the following day, even if it's direct to the vendor, do you think they're going to be flexible on the £200,000? No, probably not, because the estate agents are just setting their mind that I'm going to get you £200,000 for this house. They just put the for sale sign outside. The expectations are set that it's going to be £200,000. So even if the property is only worth £170,000, £180,000, they're not interested in hearing that at that moment in time. On the other hand, let's say 6 weeks go by and they don't have any offers. Do you think now the expectation might be coming to change? Yeah, they've become a little bit more realistic. They're thinking maybe it's not quite worth that. Maybe no one's interested at that level. Maybe it is a little bit overpriced. So that's the time to have the conversation with them, not when the property's just been listed. So you give it a few weeks, 6 weeks is a good time. Now, in this market, most of those properties might be sold anyway. And that's fine, but you haven't lost out because they're never a deal and you were never going to buy those properties. So you haven't lost anything. You're identifying the ones that are potentially a deal. Does that make sense? Excellent. Okay. How are we doing for time, Jack?
About 5 minutes and then Q&As.
Say again, sorry?
We've got about 5 minutes and then Q&A.
Oh, okay. So, right. So the next one I'm going to whiz through quickly then. So the next thing I want you to talk about is funding deals. So with finding deals as part of the equation, the other part of the equation is being able to get the money to be able to do these deals consistently. So yes, you can have a pipeline of deals and you might be sourcing these on, but sourcing is not going to make you rich. Yes, it'll bring you some money in, but if you want to get true wealth, you've got to be owning assets, you've got to be owning property, and having money to be able to buy property is important. And people talk about buying property with no money and things like this. And you know, I'm a good example of building a business from nothing. When I started, I had no money whatsoever when I started in property. And hence I was looking for the cheap, free routes to be able to try and get in. And how do you buy property, no money down, and buying a house for a pound? That's why all these things grab my attention. But the thing is, it's hard work. And if you have money, it's so much easier. But it took a little while to work out. It doesn't have to be my money. When you're purchasing a property, money has to come from somewhere. Even if you're buying at a traditional buy-to-let, the 75% mortgage from the bank and putting 25% of your money, 75% of it came from somewhere else. But in fact, all of it can come from somebody else. It doesn't have to come from you. If the deal is good, there's an opportunity to make money. There is no shortage of money around the world. There's about $1 trillion a day that changes hands. The thing is, most of it's not going through your hands. So what you've got to do is be attractive for investment. So how do you get attractive for investment? How do you become investable? The way to become investable is, first, you need to make sure that you understand the deals you're doing and be able to articulate how somebody else can make money from those, how somebody can make profit from those. It's that thing about, if I was standing on a street corner selling £10 notes for £5, I could sell them all day long because you're making money for people, right? In the same way, you've got to think about your property, how you're going to make money from somebody. Low risk. Don't do high risk stuff, especially at the beginning. If you get your fingers burnt, it takes a long time to build your reputation in this industry, and it'll take about 5 minutes to destroy it. With social media and the Facebook forums, within 5 minutes, everybody will know that you ended up doing a bad deal, you screwed somebody over. So that's not what you want to do. You want to focus on good quality deals that are low risk. That means that you're not going to lose a shirt on your back and your investor's going to make money as well. So having a solid deal is the first starting point, which is kind of what the first part of what we're talking about, i.e. finding the deals in the first place. But then you need to think about, why would somebody invest with you? Would you invest with yourself? If the deal that you've maybe found right now, if you had £100,000, would you invest that money yourself in your deal? I probably not explained that very well, but are you investable for yourself? And you've got to think about, how would you be more investable? Well, making sure your numbers are solid. And sometimes people talk about, oh, I haven't got a track record, I haven't done this before. It's not about having a track record, it's about de-risking the deal. How do you de-risk a deal if you haven't done it before? Well, you involve other people with you that have experience to de-risk the deal. Yeah. So, for example, if you had a very competent builder with you, you had a good surveyor with you, a very experienced architect, and you hadn't done this before, and those three people are part of your team, the chances of your success are now much higher than if you're trying to do this thing on your own. Yeah. So you can de-risk it. Yes, at each stage, you're giving away more of the pie. But it's better to end up with a small portion of the pie and be around to do the deals again and again, rather than trying to take a big slice of the pie and probably end up with a burnt pie and you get nothing at all. Yeah. So doing by not having a track record is no excuse. You can bring in the experience to be able to do that. And that gives confidence to your investors. If you were looking to invest your hard-earned money with somebody, what are the things you look for? You look for not only what return am I going to get, is my capital even going to come back? Is my money safe? And what are the chances of me getting the return that they've talked about? What are the things that could go wrong? What if they can't sell the property? What if the refurb costs more? What if their financing mortgage conditions change and they can't remortgage that level? What's plan B in that situation? When you work through these things, it becomes much easier then to bring people into your deals. And the other thing is understanding the difference between loans and joint ventures. Just very quickly, a loan really is a fixed amount of money for a fixed period of time for a fixed return. That's it. You're lending £100,000 for 1 year and expecting a 10% return. That's a loan. It's all those three variables are fixed. They're not variable, they are fixed. In a joint venture, you're sharing the risk and the reward. That means that your investor, if they're coming into a project with you, they're putting the money in with you in the project, there's no guarantee of a fixed return. Yeah, that return might vary depending on the outcome. So I think we've got maybe Jack, if you look at give some feedback. Holding LA.
Everyone is on mute. I'm not sure why it does that.
Oh, okay, cool. I think that's sorted now.
I'll beat it then. Thank you.
So with so I've lost trail of thought now. I've no idea what I was talking about. Can anybody let me know where I was? Oh yes, joint ventures.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah,
I remembered. See, I'm paying attention to what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So joint ventures, you're sharing the risk and the reward, so there's no guarantees. Your investor might make more, they might make less. And if the deal takes longer and it costs more, they're going to make less. But you're both going to suffer in that. So it's the sharing the risk and reward. And it's understanding the two things are different. And also, you know, when you understand that, you all need to take into consideration what the FCA guidelines are in terms of raising money. Because there are guidelines there. I know many people just completely ignore the rules and don't pay any attention to them. But you need to be aware. Just because the FCA haven't prosecuted any property investors under the flouting of these guidelines since 2014, it doesn't mean they won't. You don't want to be the first one. So it's just understand what those guidelines are. Focus on high net worth investors, sophisticated investors. It makes it much easier when you're raising money. And be visible, share what you're doing, you know, share on social media the kind of things you're up to. It's sharing your journey, not necessarily your results. It's not a case of, hey, this is what I've got, rock keys. Everyone's focusing on the flash car they've just bought, the keys, or the new house they moved into, the holiday they're on. No. Don't share the results. Share the journey, warts and all, what you're doing, viewings you're doing, people you're speaking to, you know, networking events you're at, because ultimately people do business with people they know, like, and trust. And social media is now much easier and can reduce the amount of time it takes for somebody to get to know, like, and trust you, as long as you're open in terms of what you're doing. So share what you're up to, share the things you're doing. And then that way, if you've got good deals, you invite the conversation. And one thing you want to do early is qualify people. What I try and do is try and discourage people from investing with me. Because if they're not sure, I'd rather have them out the door now than on the day we're about to exchange contracts, say, Saja, the one who ring you, actually, you'll probably just get a text because I've had it in the past. These are all from experience. You know, we've been thinking about this and I think this might not be right for us. Good luck with it. And I'm thinking, we're exchanging in 2 hours. Where am I going to get that money from now? So, you know, you want to kind of push people out of that may not be right. So you're left with a few people that are absolutely solid. You know, they're the kind of people you want to work with. And especially with joint ventures, these are long-term deals. My joint ventures I'm doing with my partners for HMOs, we have a 10-year agreement. Some marriages don't last 10 years. So you've got to make sure that you understand who you're working with, that you like them, that they're the kind of people you want to be with as well. And, you know, again, from experience, I've done deals with people that have had the money that I probably didn't really like. And very quickly, you know, I think this is a big mistake that I've got myself into. And, you know, I've walked away from deals losing money just to be able to get away and not having to work with people like that. Just because someone's got the money, it doesn't mean they're the right person. You want to be able to cherry pick. Just like having a pipeline of deals, you want a pipeline of investors that you really, you just need three good investors. You've got a deal, you'll guarantee that one of those will take it. As long as you've vetted them properly, you've qualified them properly, you've understood their needs, what they're looking for, why they're looking for that, what their expectations are, you know, not only on return, on the security, what they want to hear from you, how often they want to hear from you, all these things. If you can fulfill these things and have a good conversation like that with your investor, they'll be on board with you and they'll be on board with you for a long time. And many investors will not tell you how much money that they've got straight away. They want to test you to see if you're going to deliver what you've said. And if you deliver, then there'll be opportunity to do more and more. Some of my investors have been with me for many, many years. Others like come, they kind of, they'll come for a short period of time, they might go off to do something else. Some of them because they want to learn how we do things so they can then go do it for themselves. Or some people call it earn and learn, look over your shoulder. So you can come up with different things that work for you. But raising money is, you know, from my point of view, is the easiest part of property investing. If you've got good deals, there is no issue with finding money. The money will come and find you. People just need to be aware of what you're doing. That's the important thing. So that's a little quick snippet on finding money. Again, we do a workshop on raising money as well. And if you want to learn about any of that, just ping me a message on social media. Oops. Just ping me a message on social media. I'm happy to, you know, I'll send you the link to the video on strategy. And if you want to learn about any of the workshops that we have, all the workshops, the networking events, everything we run in Birmingham, because that's the center of the world. We've got no intention of running anything anywhere else. So it means it's either online or you've got to come to see us in Birmingham.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Wow, amazing, amazing. So I'd say when Jack asked me to co-host this session, and he said, oh, I know, I called the event Powerful Secrets of Growing Your Property Portfolio. I'm always a little bit cynical when people say secrets. Are there really going to be secrets? But literally, now I've met someone, the first person I've met who actually speaks faster than I do, I realise you have shared 2 hours of secrets condensed into 1 hour. I'm incredibly generous with the tips that you have shared. These are real practical, tangible things. I am blown away because you've been so generous and so kind to help others that have come along today, because it's real specific things that people can act on. So it's absolutely fantastic. And I think, you know, and for you, and if all else fails, you have a job with the Birmingham Tourist Board ahead of you. although I live in Bath, so I beg to differ. So we might have to compete on that. Has anyone got, I mean, to be fair, you have answered a lot, but are there questions remaining?
Ask a question to Seth here. I think this question seems to be on the mind of a lot of people. What are the top three skills you think that are required to be able to attract success in property business or be able to grow their portfolio exponentially?
So I didn't quite catch all of that. I think you're saying what the skills required for somebody
to grow. Top three skills to be able to grow portfolio faster.
Okay, I think that's two key things I talk about. You've got to be able to find deals and you've got to be able to find money. Now, we can leverage. Yeah. So, for example, if I'm using somebody else's money, I'm leveraging. But the same way, we can leverage deal sourcing as well. So we can find good people to find deals for us. So I'll just give you a tip. If you, let's say you're at a property networking event and you want to find good sources. And some networking events are given an opportunity to stand up for 10, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, share what you do and say, hey, look, raise your hand if you're sourcing property right now. And you get a number of people raising their hand. And you say, raise your hand if you'd like to earn a quick £5,000. And lots of people raise their hand. They're interested in what you're going to say and say, hey, look, I'm desperately looking for a 4-bedroom house in this part of Birmingham right now. If you can find me one, I've got £5,000 waiting here for you. Come and have a chat with me after the session. I'll be standing over here, whatever it might be. A quick little pitch like that. What we'll do, it'll be like bees around honey. You'll kind of have lots of people that will want to speak to you all of a sudden because they think you're throwing away £5,000. But what you need to do is very quickly then filter and say, right, who's actually going to be worth speaking to? Unfortunately, too many people will have just done a course and think that a property source and never sourced anything. So the question I ask is, tell me about the last three deals you sourced. That's what I ask. That's the only thing I'm interested in. I'm meeting a new sourcer. And then very quickly I can work out, there's something about this person. I think, well, maybe not quite yet. You know, when you've got a little bit more experience, maybe come back and have a chat to me politely. So even though you're kind of, you're standing out saying, hey, look, you know, I've got this, I'm interested in looking for this. And you're trying to grab attention of the sources. Very quickly you'll filter out. There's only one or two that you might have a meaningful conversation with. So I think, yes, sourcing, by finding deals and finding money, really they're the things that you need, and that the you can use your then time and skills in building your systems or processes to be able to scale that way. But having that skill, I think, is important. And as you don't have to do it yourself, you can leverage out to other people.
Brilliant. Thank you, Seth. Thank you.